We believe it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I am one of them too. I must have this thing. Jim Cornette is a fellow that I see up at the Atlanta Men's Workshop often, and he is very involved in the friendship group in Buford, Georgia. It's a Fusion Church. It's located right off Buford Highway and Lake Lanier Parkway. It's a Sunday night meeting. It's at 6:30. I highly recommend it. It's one of the best speaker meetings in town. Jim does a lot of work, and it's my great pleasure to introduce him here tonight. Come on up here, Jim.
How's everybody doing tonight? I'm already sweating, so I'm going to take this off. That's okay. My name's Jim, and I am an alcoholic. I love speaker meetings. I don't like being the one speaking. And let's see, we'll go through the basics real quick. My sobriety date is January 18th of 2011. My home group, as Tim was saying, is the Friendship Group in Buford, Georgia. We have a 20-minute and a 40-minute speaker every Sunday night at 6:30. We had a huge weekend this weekend, along with the Primary Purpose Group and the Fifth Tradition Group. We had a book study over at Ridgeview with Bob Darrell and... get the other speaker's name, but they went through the book and the steps Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, and then Sunday night Bob Darrell came and spoke at our group, which he's one of my favorite speakers, and I was chairing the meeting, so I was really nervous about introducing him, and I'm not as bad as I am now, but I just had a really great weekend, and when Tim asked me to speak tonight, I knew after going through all of that that I was probably going to be as spiritually fit as I'm capable of getting. So let's see, I do have a sponsor. I do sponsor other men. Currently it's only one other guy, and it's kind of an interesting story how that happened. I had only been back for a couple months after my last run, and there was a guy standing at the Hawk Club up in Gainesville looking at the book cabinet, and so I went up and asked him, do you need a book? And they said, yeah, I do. So I went and got to my head key and got him a book, and then the meeting started, and after the meeting I could see him coming across the room to me, and I'm like, oh man, he's going to want me to sponsor him. And then it turned out to be the one of the best things that's happened in my sobriety. To see somebody else recover. And to see his wife come back. I mean, during about 6 months into working with him, he got divorce papers, and we didn't think he was going to get a second chance. And the loss of a relationship was what led into my last run, which what contributed to it. And so I was just convinced that I'm supposed to show him what it's like to lose somebody and not get her back. And it turned out to be the other way around. I got to see him get his family back. I'm the GSR of my home group. I participate at the district level with H&I. I do every Wednesday at 7 at Avita. It's the crisis stabilization unit, kind of a detox center. I get to take a meeting there, and my voice is shaking. I'm going to take a meeting there, and that's probably the second biggest thing that helps me today is to get to see people that are fresh. And just a couple of weeks ago, I've got a little routine where I go through the steps with them really quickly, and we got to the fifth step, and we're talking about the exact nature of our wrongs, and this one girl raised her hand, she goes, but I'm not selfish. It's like, really? So, do you have children? She said, yeah. It's like, but she said, but I always put their needs first. I take care of everything, and then when they're taken care of, I can do my stuff. It's just, I mean, how we just can't see it, you know. I couldn't see it either when Christmas night of 2002 was the first time I got arrested and was forced into recovery. And I was convinced I hadn't been affecting anybody. You know, I was self-sufficient at the time. I had a job, I had my own home. Mostly just really hardcore partied every weekend, drank. And didn't say that, you know, I wasn't a very good employee, I wasn't a very good son, wasn't a very good partner. Just couldn't see that at all. And it was just to have somebody mirror that back to me. You know, I hadn't really thought about that. That was 10 years ago. Over the course of the next few years, I impacted everybody in my life very directly. And it's really clear how I harmed them today. I'm a firm believer in the 12 steps and the 12 traditions. Having said that, I probably will use some last names. You know, inside the AA meeting, it's not anonymous here. The way I see it, I have the level of press radio and films outside of here. I won't disclose your names, but also kind of not 100% clear on the singleness of purpose thing. I see that you guys do have a sign up here. Other substances are in my story. I don't feel the need to elaborate on those today or identify myself as anything other than an alcoholic in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. But I rarely see anybody these days that are pure alcoholics. And the one spot C that I do have now, which, you know, in the past I questioned whether somebody like me should work with somebody that was just an alcoholic. And Rick, my current spot C, just drank. So, all right. So, a few other things I think are kind of funny. We talk about no major decisions in the first year. And the third step says we got to make a decision, right? So, it's kind of funny. But I do get the point. I mean, you know, it's not a good idea to divorce your wife because you think things aren't going to work out. You know, give it some time, and you know, maybe they will, maybe they won't. The other ones, you know, we can't diagnose someone else's alcoholism. I mean, I can spot an alcoholic a mile away. I think the point is that we can't convey to them, or it's very difficult for us to convey with them with enough emphasis where they believe it. But again, that's kind of what the first step's about when we're working with somebody new. We got to convince them, right? And then working with others, it talks about, you know, we're supposed to determine whether or not they're an alcoholic before we work with them. So, I made a few notes of this, just kind of like a couple of bookkeeping things. So, in my life, I've got this really minimized. I've elaborated on it before, and I found myself at the end of the meeting, and I hadn't talked about God or the steps or anything, so I'm going to go through this really quick with some highlights. I've had a pretty typical childhood. My dad left when I was young, which is pretty common these days. My parents are divorced. But, of course, I blamed all of my problems on him. Everything would have been different if he'd have stayed home and raised me like he should have, I thought. I had my first drink about the age of six. Which I think they thought it was funny because they got a picture of me doing it. And it was apple brandy and white lightning. And the person in the picture, it tastes awful, but everybody was paying attention to me, and it made me feel good. So before it was over with, they were hiding the bottle from me. It's about as much of it as I can remember. My first drug, I was 12, it was marijuana, and I found it in my mom's room. First time I did cocaine, I was 16, I found it in my dad's bathroom. So I think this is a family disease. Unfortunately, they didn't have the consequences that I do. But also at the age of 12, I started running. I moved from my mom's house to my dad's house. I went to four different high schools, to a couple of boarding schools to get away from home. Went to two different colleges, flunked out of two different colleges. And my dad suggested I join the Army. And so, of course, I had to one up him, and I joined the Marine Corps. So, hoorah. Somehow or another, I made it through 4 years of that and actually did pretty well. You know, I mean, of course, they liked the way we drink. You know, it was completely accepted. So did a lot more drinking, a whole lot less of the other stuff for 4 years. And ended up getting caught on a urinalysis test like 3 months before I got out. But we had came home for Christmas, smoked pot, and ended up being kicked out. Let's see. After college, or after the Marine Corps, college was easy. You know, I got a bachelor's degree, master's degree, got a great job with a big Fortune 15 company. Left there and went to work for a Silicon Valley software company that did planning software. And so I got to travel, be a consultant, implement systems. It's the perfect job for an alcoholic. You know, didn't have to check in to the home office. I was on site for maybe 3 months, so they never got to know me good enough to know that there was something fishy going on with this guy. You know, I'd show up on Monday here. irritable and restless, and you know, they thought I was a go-getter, and they're like, man, we got a good guy. he's running the show. So anyway, things looked good on the outside, you know, but on the inside it was awful. I was awful, terribly lonely. Wanted something to change, and of course didn't know what that was. So by the time that I finally got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was perfectly configured to not get this thing at all. You know, I was way too smart. I'd had way too much success in spite of my alcoholism, and doing what we do was just not even conceivable. You know, to let go of control. Are you kidding me? So that's pretty much what life looked like before I got, like I said, before I got arrested the first time. I had no intentions of stopping. You know, I needed to get out of trouble, and the harder stuff, I needed to stop doing that. It was really clear that those things were bad. But to drink and maybe smoke a little pot and maybe take a few pills, you know, that had to be okay. I really needed that to be okay. And over the course of the next few years of trying to make that work, I just failed miserably. And got out of I had 3 years probation from the first charge, and I got off after 18 months. And by 2005, I was homeless. I had a car, had a little truck, and was on the streets. It was cold one winter, so I figured I would just go south. I went to Miami. And so I was on the streets in Miami, hustling, doing whatever I had to do to get what I needed to get by. And ultimately came back home and asked for help, went to treatment again. I had gone to treatment for the first time that I got in trouble. This was the second attempt. Ended up 5 different treatment centers, 2 of them 2 times. I called it the OOs my lost decade, because there wasn't a whole lot accomplished besides me ripping everybody that I knew's life in two. And finally in 2007, I got another arrest and was mandated to a year of treatment. And I went to MAR. I went to another treatment center, but ended up at MAR. And was there for almost 18 months. And finally did a 4th step with a sponsor. Went through the rest of the steps and was available to sponsor other people. Did the whole deal. And life got better. Wish I could say it stayed that way, but I got out of that treatment center, went back home, and didn't get plugged in to AA there. I got a girlfriend that liked to smoke pot, and nature took its course. And within a short period of time, I was doing all the same old things again. And so, August of 2010. I had been trying for most of the first of 2010 to stop again. I was going to meetings, trying to do the things that had worked before, and here's what happened. Couldn't stop. And so I decided, you've done your best. Let's burn it down one more time. I'd had a little bit of success when I got home. My dad and I were buying foreclosed houses, fix them up and sell them, and the market was flooded with them. And my dad's real well off. He had cash. We were buying them for dirt cheap, fixing them up, and still selling them for less than they were really worth and making money. And so between August and January of August 2010, January 2011, went to about $10,000 or $15,000, and I never thought it would last that long. I thought, you know, maybe 2 months, maybe 3 months, and then when it was all gone, I was going to kill myself. And somehow or another, Thanksgiving came, and then it was Christmas, and then it was 2011. And it was just, I couldn't understand why I was still here. My easy way out was I didn't have enough guts to put a gun to my head, and figured the easy way was to find a garage, pull my car inside, turn on the radio, kick back, and fall asleep. So I think it was before Thanksgiving, but I'm not really sure. I found a place, and then I tried it. And I was in there for 3 hours. I didn't get tired. I didn't get a headache. I was looking for cracks. I mean, there was a little crack in the window. I put a piece of tape over it, and just like, why is this not working? Obviously, I guess a lot of people point out to me, God wasn't done with me. So, let's see, it was December 28th. I had I had acquired some things that belonged to other people and gone to an auction and sold them. And I got home with a pocket full of things we don't talk about in meetings. And there was a card on my door from my probation officer to come check in the next morning. I had been on non-report. So I stayed in my place that night and got up about 6, or was still up about 6 the next morning, and left again. Like, I had taken off in August and stayed in hotels for a while. And a couple of months later, I came back to my townhouse that technically my dad owned, and went in, and all my stuff was still there. I expected somebody else to be living there by now. He moved me out and rented it or sold it or something. But, so I just moved back in. And so anyway, January 18th, 3 weeks later, enough time for my system to get clear of the substances that didn't need to be in my body, I went and gave him a clean screen and lied, that I hadn't done anything. Found out later my sister had gone and told him that, what was going on. And it's kind of mixed emotions there, really pissed and really thankful that, that was what ultimately brought me back. So, that's pretty much my story. I take this detox meeting to Avita, and I go through the steps with them. So that's really what I want to spend most of the time on tonight. I think my voice is quick cracking. I came to meetings for the longest time and didn't understand what it was we were supposed to do. I mean, these things on the wall are supposed to stop me from drinking and doing the things that I like to do. No, I didn't see how the two fit together. And I still hear a lot of people say that you don't need to understand why this works. You just need to do it. But it's real clear why it works, and I'll explain to you as we go through. First step. And admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. So what powerless over alcohol, what does that mean? And according to our book and the doctor's opinion, it talks about what's we drink, but alcohol or some substance in our body, that being an alcoholic or an addict, our body says we want more, and we're going to provide more, and it's an insatiable, unquenchable thirst. So once we start, we can't stop. Okay? Second part of that is the obsession of the mind. And most of you guys probably know this stuff, but that is one thing, too. The way that I'm going to address this is for somebody that's new. Over the course of time, these steps come to mean so much more. But for somebody that's brand new, Chris Raymer talks about it being like triage. We're stopping the bleeding, we're starting the breathing, we're protecting the wound, we're keeping them from dying. And it's an urgent type thing to go through it quickly. So there's the obsession of the mind. We stop drinking, we're separated from the substance, and life doesn't suit us. The wife, the husband, the children, the job, whatever. Nothing goes the way we'd like it to go. We're restless, we're irritable, we're discontented, and the only thing that takes that away is to take another drink. And therefore, we start that cycle. We take a drink, we can't stop. Once we stop, we can't stay stopped. Okay. The second part of the first step is that our lives become unmanageable. Okay. Despite our best efforts, trying our hardest to make things work, we can't keep that job. We can't keep that relationship. Nothing goes into place the way it's supposed to, and we fail miserably. My favorite lines in the Big Book is, our problems pile up on us and become astonishingly difficult to solve. That's the story of my life. How did I get here again? It's infuriating. So, I forgot to say that the first three steps doesn't give us a whole bunch of instructions about that in the book, about what we're supposed to do. It's about agreeing with them or not agreeing with them. And it's a state of mind, essentially. So if you can agree that, that's what happens when I drink, I can't stop drinking. And when I stop drinking, I can't stay stopped. And things aren't working out for me too much right now, then maybe the first step is true for you. If that's the case, we'll go on to step two. If you don't agree with that, then we're kind of stuck here. Maybe you need to do some more drinking, and when you get ready, come back. All right. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And early on for me, that was a huge roadblock. You know, there wasn't a power greater than me. You know, my life had basically been the first three steps in reverse. You know, I had to control everything because you couldn't trust people and they weren't very good at it. If you wanted it done right, I had to do it. And so to turn this whole thing around, like I said, I was perfectly configured to not get this. But, so I like to emphasize with new people that you know, it's not saying that if I came to believe in God or I came to become a Christian or I came to be anything else other than I can be open-minded to that idea. I'm not resistant to it anymore, which I was hugely resistant. So it could be as simple as that. I mean, there's not a whole, like I said, there's not a whole lot of instructions in the book on how to do one or two. Everything up to page 43 is talking about the first step. And then we get to the agnostics on 44, it starts talking about step two. And again, it's just, do we agree with that, or are we resistant to that idea? And another way I've heard it described was, on the off chance that there is a God and you were to ask Him, might He help you? And I was actually able to swallow that. You know, it's like, I'm not saying He is, but if He is, He probably fixed me. He made everything else and controls everything else. So that can probably happen. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. So, again, they actually used the word God there, so I was like, again, once somebody that had actually done the steps before and understood the book took me through it and explained it in a way that a hard-headed guy like me can understand, I didn't have so much problem with it. You know, first step is, I'm not doing such a good job myself. Second step, you know, something else might can do it better than me if I let them. Third step, I'm going to let them. And again, most of you guys probably know this one too, but they said, you know, if there's three birds sitting on the wire and one decides to fly away, how many birds are sitting on the wire? And the detox guys, I always have to tell them quickly, it's a trick question because they want to say two. But it is a trick question. One decided to fly away. He hasn't done anything yet. You got to take action, which is essentially that I'm going to do the rest of these steps. And when it's presented like that, it's kind of simple. And when I work with somebody new today, we'll do these first three steps. The night they ask me, or very quickly thereafter, and I give them a fourth step worksheet, and I give them 2 weeks. And if they're not back within the 2 weeks, then we go to Starbucks or Waffle House, and we sit down and we do their fourth step. Because I was so resistant to that. Years I couldn't or wouldn't finish it. I'd get with a sponsor, we'd do 1, 2, and 3. He'd tell me to go do my fourth step, and I wouldn't call him anymore. But I was fearful of it. You know, hear people talk about me, it's like, oh man, this fourth step, bad stuff. And it's absolutely nothing like that. It's not all the deep, dark secrets and all the things that make you a horrible person. It's about how we don't understand things correctly. We misinterpret the world. And when it's affecting like that, it's, I wanted to know where I was wrong. You know, I wanted to see reality. And in fact, my first higher power was reality, because it was pointed out to me really clearly that very first treatment center I went to in 2003, my counselor asked me why I was there. And I lost him this big tirade about how I had left this great job to move home, and my dad drove me crazy again, and blah, 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 and now I'm here. She's like, really? I said, why are you really here? And I was convinced that all those outside things caused me to be there. And I just couldn't see it. It was all me. So, fourth step, we made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of details so I can get finished with everything, but essentially we look at our resentments, our fears, and our relationships. And a resentment is, you know, it's not just being angry at somebody. Resentment is a level above that. You know, I feel like somebody has harmed me, and like I said, it's more than just being angry. I mean, resentment is persistent. I can't stop thinking about it. When I think about it, I just want to kill that SOB. And and it really causes a lot of distress. And I hear about people talking about doing 20-page fourth steps. I'm like, are you serious? I mean, how can you have that many things that are driving you that crazy? I mean, you should be in a suit in a padded room somewhere if 20 pages worth of stuff is killing you. You can, I mean, seriously, there's a pretty short list of the stuff that's really, really bothering you. Again, this is for somebody new over the course of time. I'm still learning what a fourth step looks like at 2.5 years sober, you know. There's fewer of them because I don't let them build to that level. I try to stay aware. But so anyway, it's those few things that are really, really eating your lunch. And we look at those, and we've got a process that we go through if you've got a good sponsor where they'll show you how you're misinterpreting the whole thing and how probably blown out of proportion, and I probably started the whole thing to start with. So, and then we got fears. And for guys, we're not supposed to be afraid of anything, right? And particularly where I came from. You know, I was a Marine. I don't have fear. And when the truth of the thing is, everything that we do is driven by fear. I pretend to be something that I'm not because I don't feel like I'm good enough on my own, so I pretend to be what I think it is you want me to be, because I'm afraid of being rejected, and I'm afraid of being thought less than. So, you know, when I'm around men, I got to be a little bit taller, a little bit stronger, a little bit bulkier, you know, up and up the front. Around women, oh my goodness, the things we'll do to get you to do what we want to do. It's crazy. We act completely nuts. And so we misinterpret all of this stuff, and it causes us to act like fools, and we don't see it at all. And that's what, you know, with the fourth step, we go through this process of identifying those things and understanding why they're causing us to act that way, and we can stop doing it, or, you know, try to stop doing it. And then with the relationships, from the male perspective, what a lot of us seem to do is that we have the same relationship over and over and over and over again with different women. And they all fit the same profile. They're not very strong-willed. For me, they like to have sex and do things like that. They're attractive. And looking back, I didn't intentionally do any of that. So I didn't pick those people on purpose. But looking back, it was real clear that's what they were. Because if they were, you know, strong-willed or confident and capable people, they wouldn't have been with me. You know, they wouldn't have put up with me for very long. So they had to fit that profile, or it didn't last. They said, "Enough with you. Get out of here." And so that's what the fourth step is about for me. We identify these patterns, and we identify these misunderstandings, and we stop letting them control our lives. So, fifth step, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being, the exact nature of our wrongs. And this is where you get to tell some more of the dirty, dark secrets. You know, so you go through the fourth step with your sponsor, and he'll help you see, you know, how those fears and resentments are misleading you. And then you can, you know, disclose your deep, dark secret that you weren't ever supposed to tell anybody. I was never going to do that with one thing, and actually had a sponsee disclose it to me, the exact thing I was never going to tell anybody, and I was like, I'll be damned. So I finally got it. I did that too. I finally got to get that one off my back and to get those things off of your shoulders and not carry that burden around anymore. I mean, that's why this stuff works. I mean, we're going through it. We're not deluded anymore and letting all these things control us the way they used to. We're getting these burdens off of our shoulders, and we're not having to carry the weight of the world anymore. That's why this stuff works. We're fixing our lives. So, and then the exact nature of our wrongs. What are the exact natures of our wrongs? We're selfish, we're self-centered, we're self-seeking, we're frightened, we're inconsiderate, dishonest, lustful. All those things that aren't real good character qualities. You know, people don't like hanging out with people that are like that. So, so there. So we, with our sponsor, we've come to understand how we fit that description. And then step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. In the big book, there's two paragraphs. One paragraph for each of these, and then for the first time through, I think that's probably good. You know, because we can't. I think it takes some time before you get to see how how much 6 and 7 are really at the core of everything that we do. But with somebody new, like step 6, go back and look at 1 through 5. Did you leave anything out? Is there something you should have told me you didn't tell me? Feel good about it? And we got a prayer for the sixth or for the seventh step. Seventh step, humbly asking to remove our shortcomings. And again, we say the prayer, and then we do an eighth step list. Step 8, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And if you want to be afraid of one, this is the one that scares me, because I harmed a lot of people. Like I said, when I first got here, I didn't see how I had harmed that many people, but. And this one that I kind of skipped over. I thought I needed to include the people that were close and the things that were further away that were going to be hard to make amends about anyway. Why bother putting them on my list? But it does say all persons and make amends to them all. It says all twice. So now I've got a very long eight-step list. There was one that I got invited to a Super Bowl party after I was just celebrating my first year at this time, and there's a mountaintop up in North Hall County above Gainesville. It's got all this Motorola equipment, and I guess more now it's probably more cell phones and things like that. But when we were teenagers, we went up and tore the hell out of that place, and it was something I had forgotten about. And I was on my way to the Super Bowl party, I look up and see all this equipment, and I'm like, oh man, I made a list. That's on my Instagram list. I have no idea how I'm going to make amends for it yet. I'm not going to turn myself in for it, but I will make amends somehow. And the book's pretty clear about how to do that stuff, too. Some people think they do need to turn themselves in. I think that I'm doing a much better job if I'm out here helping people and providing for the family and doing that sort of thing than sit in jail. But I'll make amends somehow. So the eighth step is just about making the list and becoming willing. Some of those people I thought deserved it, and I didn't think I needed to make amends to them. So that's, we get them all written down, and we get to a place where we're okay with, all right, even though I do think they probably deserved it somewhat, I got to clean up my side if I want to stay sober. Step 9, make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Again, if you want to be afraid, that's going out and facing these people is a fearful thing. But what I found is that everybody has been very receptive, particularly the first time that I did it back in 2007, 2008. When I came back around this time, the very first person that I went to is my little sister. And so she's just been perfect, sweet little angel, never had any trouble. And I was being manipulative, too, because I knew if I got to her that I'd get back with my dad. But when I went to talk to her, she's like, it's been 2 months. No. Do you need to demonstrate a little bit more? And then she shut me down. I'm like, whoa. Didn't expect that. But the first time, everybody was very receptive early on. Everybody said, thank God you're doing something about this. And they just want me to be happy and sober and stop taking their things. but then I have heard people talk about very bad experiences where they just were not welcome. Actually, to be honest, I had a relationship over the last winter, and I haven't made amends yet to her, and she's not open to that. So. One that just popped in my head that I'm not welcome at her home. So 4 through 9. 1, 2, 3, we're getting our head straight that this is where we are and this is what we got to do. 4 through 9, we go through and we understand the things we've been misunderstanding. We've approached all the people that we've hurt, and we're fixing those things. That's why this works. We're cutting out all the things that make our lives screwed up. And when our lives are straightened out, that obsession goes away. Like I said, there's people who are so insistent that you can't understand why it works. It's really clear now to me why it does. And if somebody had told me this early on, I might have been more receptive and might have been more willing to do some of it. But it took me a long time. Okay, so 4 through 9, we're cleaning up the wreckage of our past. Step 10, 11, and 12, we try to keep it that way. And, right. 10th step is probably my favorite today. Continue to take personal inventory of when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. And, Actually, ended up making a t-shirt out of a resentment over the 10th step because so many people talk about doing the 10th step inventory at night, and then like that's not what the big book says. The big book literally says we continue to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. Talk to someone quickly. Talk about it with someone at once. Make amends quickly if we harm someone, and turn our attention to somebody we can help. And that's not writing something down at the end of the day. That's like, as it's going on, I'm seeing it and stopping it before it progresses. And to me, it's about being awake and not going through life in the dark anymore and finding myself in this place going, how in the heck did I get here again? You know, because I'm seeing it coming and I'm cutting it off. That's the 10th step, being awake. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And this is the one where we have the evening review, but and that's what it actually starts with. This is when retiring at night, we constructively review our day. So we get to the end of the day, we look back. How did I do? You know, was I selfish, dishonest, frightened? You know, were those character defects present in my life today? And early on, they still were a lot most of the time. And after going through this for a while and being really diligent about 10 and 11, they get less. And there were more things I look back on and like I did something good that day. Instead of I hurt somebody, I helped somebody. And like I said, so you identify the things that you didn't do so well. Say a little prayer, God, help me not to be that person anymore. An asshole anymore. Really, the truth is, I don't want to be that guy. Help me to not do that. Wake up the next morning. Upon awakening, we think about 24 hours ahead. We make general plans for the day. That's something I get to do today. I was talking to a friend before the meeting that you know I do landscape maintenance. I have a lawnmower and meat eater and backpack blower and all the things that I need to do that. And I had all the time in the world. So you know, I'm gonna leave late one morning. You know, I still take time to do this before I leave the house. And anyway, I was thinking about saying something else. I'll bring that up in a second. So, and before I launch myself out in the world, I get my head straight and I get good with God and I say a prayer, do meditation, and then I leave. Which is the way that I used to live was I came to, I'm late, I'm rushing out the door, and all these bad things happen. Again, that's why this stuff works. You know, I'm not doing that crazy stuff before. It's like, it's just so obvious. And then there's the one place that is, I want to say there's a flaw in the big book is the part about if we pause from agitated and doubtful to me sounds like the 10th step. You know, whatever. It is, so upon awakening and when we retire at night and then when we're agitated or doubtful, we pause. And it's got some pretty cool promises there about not burning up energy foolishly trying to run the world and things just start falling into place and life slows down. And again, it's like I said, like 10 and 11 are where I feel like today is where I live. Okay, step 12. Having had a spiritual experience as the result of those steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. So, for the longest time, I didn't understand these steps, and I dang sure didn't know what a spiritual experience was. And my conception of God is really simple today. Like I said, I started out, it was just reality. It was something going on that I wasn't tuned in with, and I was open to learning what that was. And it hasn't changed a whole lot. It's not a whole lot more complicated than that. It seems to me that the more stuff that I try to attribute to God, the less I'm really understanding of it. So it's very fundamental, very basic. I'm not even sure if he's conscious or not. He's given us the energy and infinite possibility and that sort of stuff. And I don't know if you follow what I mean by that. But I guess in a nutshell, is if if God is infinite possibility and everything, then it seems to me that the whole purpose of this whole thing, of Him having us, is to experience finite experience. If He sees what it's like to not be everything through us, and if everything was predetermined, to me that seems like what's the point of even doing it? It's like playing a video game over and over again that you know what's going to happen. So I think that's the whole point of this whole thing, is for Him to see what happens when He just, here you go, you take this little part, and go have fun, and He's watching what we do. Pretty simplistic, but it works for me. And another way, a spiritual experience means that I've changed the way I look at life, I see myself, definitely the way I look at other people, because I didn't think a whole lot of you guys before, and the way I think about God. And it also says having had, so I dare you to go through this stuff and not have one. It doesn't happen. To do these steps to the best of your ability and to continue to do the work, I've never seen anybody fail. And every time that I've failed, I've stopped doing this and I've started taking control again. And pretty soon it seems like a good idea to take a drink. Second part of the 12th step is we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. That's kind of what I'm doing now. And it's this message is the 12 steps, the way they're outlined in the book. It's not to come to a meeting and share your problems. And third, to practice these principles in all our affairs. Again, I try to be a decent person today. Still struggle with it a lot because all those things are still there and are kept at bay. It's funny, I got out of the shower, was about to get dressed to come down here, and I had some melatonin and some nighttime sleep aid. I'm like, yeah, I can take one of those before I get up and talk. I bet I wouldn't be nervous. and that's like, but it was just so ingrained. I want to have something that I can put into me to make me feel different. And I fail miserably when I start trying to do those things. So that's pretty much what I do every Wednesday. I run through them really quickly with that, and I've got an area directory. Most of the people are in the North Georgia area, but I can get my phone number, tell them where the meeting's at. It's really a good time. A lot of days, particularly this summer, we had so much rain. I had to ask other people to cover for me, so I've probably missed 6 or 7 total. I really miss if the Wednesdays I don't get to do that meeting. Again, like I said, I really love speaker meetings. AA was starting up, that's all we had were speaker meetings and Bible studies and step studies and things like that. And I think our message gets real diluted in open discussion meetings. To me, they're kind of poorly run group therapy because there's usually nobody there to run the group. At least in the treatment center, you've got somebody that's qualified to run the meeting and to come in and tell a bunch of alcoholics and people that thought like I thought that I'm the most important person in the room and tell me about your problems. It's like, all right, you guys finally understand where I'm coming from, and I need to tell you about my stuff. I just don't see how that's so helpful. So that's where I spend most of my time. I'd like to thank you guys for inviting me tonight. Not sure when I'm supposed to stop, but I guess I'm probably getting pretty close. Thank you, Tim. Thanks to the Navi Group, and thanks to my friends who came out tonight.